We start today's program with an exploration of what's next, or should be next, for Arizona's Child Protective Services. Last week, Department of Economic Security Director Clarence Carter revealed that 6,000 reported cases of possible child abuse were set aside and not investigated. Some are calling for Carter to resign his position, but Governor Jan Brewer says she's not going to take any action until the State Department of Public Safety finishes looking into the situation. Maricopa County Attorney Bill Montgomery was co-chair of the Governor's Child Safety Task Force with Clarence Carter and joins me now. Bill, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Clarence Carter says he can have all 6,000 cases preliminarily reviewed by Monday. He says all can be investigated to the extent necessary by the end of January. What do you think of those steps so far?
Well, those two steps right there do show that swift action is being taken. And I don't think as the Maricopa County attorney, I could ask for more under the circumstances. Obviously, I don't want the circumstances to begin with, but the concerted effort to get those reviewed, as well as what I saw in the plan, was the utilization of all of the Office of Child Welfare investigators to assist in that, particularly to check for any criminal conduct, is exactly what I would want to see in that regard.
Bill, considering the time you put in as co-chair of this task force, were you surprised when all this came out? What was your first reaction?
What the hell was going on?
Yeah.
That, you know, when the administrative action of classifying some cases as NI or not investigated began in earnest in 2011, Steve, that was the very time that we were up to our necks in trying to figure out what we could do to assist CPS in carrying out their core mission of providing social services to families in need, and yet take away the duty to investigate allegations of criminal conduct for the sole purpose of trying to alleviate the workload and create conditions for success for that agency. And as a result of that work that we did, you had the administration include in their budget request specific resources for CPS, and you had a Republican-controlled legislature that understood that request and provided those very resources. So you had a sort of a perfect storm for CPS to be completely upfront about their resource needs, and instead, that's when they decided to start hiding cases.
Whether people want to blame Clarence Carter or not, whether he should resign, as some have said that he should, it seems like this problem is so enormous and it has been for so long that it's not going to take one person to turn it around. It's going to take a lot more than that. If you were designing a system like this, whether Carter stays or not, do there have to be a lot more people involved in the decision-making process? Does there have to be a teardown of CPS?
Well, I think what we need to do at first is check into exactly why and who people thought that this was a good idea, particularly given the environment that I just outlined where CPS was in a win-win situation. Mm-hmm. And my concerns are twofold. One, is it in fact the leadership of the agency that is wholly responsible for what happened, or is there somehow with the current organization of that agency that leads to a culture in which these kinds of actions are seen as not only permissible, but somehow an acceptable form of managing resources? And in that regard, I want to follow the administrative review that the Department of Public Safety is going to conduct and see what we learn from that before taking next steps. Calling for the head of Clarence Carter, I'm sorry, that's political low-hanging fruit, and that's not going to assist us in trying to identify what the root causes are for what happened.
And I guess, Bill, sort of coming back to the same thing, though, when you have something that is identified as systemic failure, clearly it's not Carter's fault, but it seems like there has to be some sort of a modification in terms of the direction that things go. Is CPS, you talk about low-hanging fruit, has this become a political football, and it shouldn't be that because we're talking about the safety of kids?
Oh, absolutely, Steve. I think that you hit the nail on the head for one of the troubling aspects of what has followed with the revelation of this situation and these 6,000 cases. First and foremost, it sends the wrong message that if you, as the head of a department and state government, reveal information that reflects a complete and total failure of an agency that you supervise, that the first thing that's going to happen is you're going to lose your job. That's the wrong message to send. Also, we've got people who are jumping ahead of what needs to be a very sober reflection on what happened. And we've even got agencies that pretend to be advocates for children. For example, the Children's Action Alliance. In 2008, we tried to engage in reforms specifically to change the mission statement for CPS to focus on the protection of children and to put into statute specific protections for children who are victims of crime that I believe would have forestalled this from happening. And it was the Children's Action Alliance that were carrying the veto messages from then-Governor Napolitano that if we did either of those two things, the legislation was doomed for failure. And for them now to want to cherry-pick this issue and act like they're equally appalled, they're part of the reason why we've had the status quo for so long. And we need to get beyond this and stay focused on what are the specific lessons that we can pull out of this? Who are the specific people who were involved? You know, for all the calls for the firing of Clarence Carter, he's the head of DES. He's not the head of CPS. And yet again, we're jumping over the agency and wanting to take out an easy target instead of focusing on where the source of the issue is.
So you're saying Children's Action Alliance is just going after politics here?
Oh, yeah, they're using this as a fundraising tool. I'm disgusted by it. If they were really so concerned about children, look, their willingness to fend off substantial statutory changes in 2008 have led me ever since to refer to them as the Children's Inaction Alliance. They're the last people who ought to be trying to act like they have any kind of moral indignation now at what happened. They were arm in arm with the Napolitano administration back then when we were trying to get things done, as I said, that I believe would have helped forestall this. And I understand it's the political season, but Democrats, and not all of them, but a number of Democrats who are simply calling for Clarence Carter to be fired and for a special session, are simply taking advantage of a situation. Let's let the administrative review go through so that we understand the totality of what happened here. Instead of calling for people to get fired and creating an environment in which nobody's going to want to talk or share information that we desperately need in order to try to understand the full context of this.
But Bill, isn't there a point of separation there between whether people are calling for Carter to resign and whether there should be a special session? It seems to me those are two different things. One could be seen as political. The other might be seen as a way of, well, right before the last legislative session when there was emergency funding for CPS, whether funding actually solves the problem or not, it doesn't seem like that's in the same sort of stratosphere to me. This idea that maybe a special session, let's consider this so that when the administration report comes out, we're in a better place to act quickly.
And I don't necessarily disagree with that characterization. If the call for a special session then came on the heels of the report when we know what needs to be acted on. But the call for a special session now, I think, is just way too opportunistic. We don't know the full depths of what happened for a special session to understand the parameters in which it would need to act.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. A few more minutes left with Maricopa County Attorney Bill Montgomery. We're talking about the latest revelations about Child Protective Services. Bill, let's go to this number of 6,000 cases. One of the things you and I talked about in the past when you were co-chair of the task force is this idea of getting more people comfortable with the idea of telling their story, whether it's neighbors, whether it's people who see something that may be abuse and are willing to come forward to talk about it. When we hear about all these cases, whether the ball was dropped on them or not, are we seeing more cases or are we seeing people more comfortable reporting them?
Well, I think that's two sides of the same coin. I think the reason why we're seeing more cases and there are more calls to the hotline is because people heard the call, no pun intended, to be more involved, and if they thought that they saw evidence of potential abuse or neglect, to then report it. Because under both our civil and criminal statutes in Arizona, you can make an honest mistake, no harm, no foul, and better for you to be embarrassed for a couple of weeks than to live a lifetime of regret because you failed to report something and a fatality resulted as a consequence of that. So I think what underlies this point, too, that you're raising, I don't want the public, whether Maricopa County or around the state, to become so disenchanted and cynical with the child welfare system that they simply throw up their hands and walk away from it. We need the public to continue to be involved and to report when they believe they see instances of abuse and neglect, in particular our mandatory reporters. And that's why this is so maddening to me, too. We did get the public response. So now it is incumbent upon the child welfare system to honor that response and to fulfill its statutory mandate.
When we started our conversation, I mentioned some of the plans that Clarence Carter has outlined. The plan was released a few hours later than people expected it to be. First of all, do you think it was sufficiently detailed? Do we know enough about what the steps are? I outlined, as I said, a couple of the steps. Is there enough detail there? And part two of that, which I guess is the exact opposite question, which is the fact that we have these cases, and now we have, whether we're going to blame Carter or we're going to blame somebody else, the ball was dropped in a major way. Are we better off actually having this plan outlined really quickly and have it be some sort of half-baked plan as opposed to waiting until a good plan, a real plan that is comprehensive, can come out?
Well, one of my favorite Patton quotes is that a good plan well executed is better than the best plan poorly executed. And in this particular instance, I don't think we can lose sight of the fact that we had the identification, report, public disclosure, and a plan to address it occur all within roughly a two-week period. For bureaucracy, that's lightning speed. So the other thing that I would point out, and I respect the fact that there are some fellow members of the Oversight Committee, including some of the chairs of it, who wanted to see more detail. And I'm not going to fault their criticism. Their focus is different than what I'm looking at it for, which is to get the cases reviewed and to get investigations initiated as quickly as possible. So in those terms, the fact that there are such short deadlines and the time horizon is so quick, the fact that there are not additional details in there, I can live with, because we're going to know in short order whether or not those deadlines have been met. And then if they haven't been met, we've got the mechanism to demand accountability and to demand answers for what's going on and what's going to be done to ensure that these reviews are very thorough. So in that sense, while the plan may not have been detailed enough to sort of list every single person who may be involved in it, it identifies the specific goals for case review and investigation initiation within a short enough time frame that, even if I don't have a name on there, I know what's supposed to happen. I know when it's supposed to happen, so that we then will be able to review that and to have a measure of accountability if it doesn't. We're not waiting 6 months from now, but we're looking at the end of January for all investigations to have been initiated and kids to be checked up on.
Bill, finally, a two-part question about money. First of all, do you think more money should be put into CPS, and is funding going to become a partisan issue again, even though we're talking about the safety of kids?
I'll address the second part of that first, and then ask you if you need to remind me of the first part. Funding and the resources should not be a partisan issue, and it wasn't with the request for emergency resources for CPS once a specific need was identified. It wasn't then. It doesn't need to be going forward. However, the role that additional resources will play for CPS, I believe, also fairly, from the entire legislature's viewpoint, has got to come with a greater degree of accountability. If you're going to give CPS additional resources, positions, / personnel, and money, then, and this is something else I would look for from this administrative review, it has to be spent, those positions need to be assigned, so that we do not have a repeat of this. And I think it's fair to ask for specific plans on where those monies would be spent and where those positions would go. And one other thing I don't want to lose in all of this either, with the focus on CPS, is that the Office of Child Welfare Investigations right now only has 30 people assigned to it in total. And they need additional resources too, so that they can carry out their statutory mandate. And thank God we've got the people there that we do. Otherwise, I don't believe we ever would have heard about this. I think the insulated culture and the refusal to share information that has so often been a constant characteristic of CPS would have kept this information from ever coming out.
Bill Montgomery is Maricopa County Attorney. Bill, thanks for the time and happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you, Stephen. Same to you and your family.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll talk with a child psychiatrist about getting over problems of child abuse, if that's even possible. And then a little bit later this hour, college coaching salaries, why are they so huge? Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Bookman's Entertainment Exchange, an Arizona institution for over 30 years, offering for sale or trade books, music, movies, musical instruments, events, and more. Locations in Phoenix, Mesa, and Flagstaff. Bookmans.com.
Good morning. You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 and KJZZ.org. BBC News Hour comes your way at 1 this afternoon, and at 2, it's the world. Checking temperatures around the state right now, it's 37 degrees in Flagstaff, 47 in Prescott, 59 degrees in Tucson, 64 in Yuma. If you're headed to Sky Harbor Airport today, be aware that both the East Economy uncovered lot and the West Economy parking lot are full. The curbsides and security lines should be pretty busy today too, so allow extra time for that. Cloudy and 64 degrees in Phoenix at 11:22.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. We've been talking about problems with Arizona's Child Protective Services system, but why is CPS so necessary? Why are so many kids being abused or mistreated by parents, the ones who are supposed to raise and protect them? I'm joined now by child and adolescent psychiatrist Dr. Shane Tomasato of Desert Horizon Psychiatric Services and the Maricopa Integrated Health System. Shane, good morning. Thanks for taking the time today.
Good morning.
Can I get your quick thoughts about the number of cases related to Child Protective Services? Does it shock you that there are so many cases, not uninvestigated cases, just the number of cases generally?
No, it's not. It doesn't surprise me. Child abuse and neglect is a big problem in our society. And in fact, most cases nationwide of child maltreatment do not actually come to the attention of the police or Child Protective Services. So it is a very huge problem.
I guess we can't lump these all in together. Does that have to do with this idea of wanting to stay close to a family, not feeling comfortable reporting it? Are there certain factors involved there?
Well, it may be that it's not even seen by people, that it's a secret and something that is not immediately visible, and so people don't know to report it.
Is there, in fact, a continuing cycle of abuse that we often hear about, this idea that if one generation has been abused, it's more likely the next generation will continue that?
Well, being abused in the past is a risk factor to going on to abuse your own children. In fact, about a third of individuals who've been maltreated will go on to maltreat their child in some way. And maltreatment encompasses physical abuse, neglect, sexual abuse, and so on. But that means that two-thirds of people who've been maltreated do not go on to abuse their own children.
Well, are there certain signs that make those people, gosh, I don't know, able to overcome it more? Do they seek therapy and they're able to overcome it that way?
Well, that is difficult to say, but there is some evidence that having emotionally supportive relationships in both your adult life and your childhood can be somewhat protective in you not going on to abuse your own children. For example, if a child is abused by one caretaker but has really good relationships outside of the home or relatives with whom they have good relationships, that can be helpful. Also, if in their adult life they have very emotional supportive relationships, that can be helpful.
Can you tell us about some of the methods that you've come across that you've used yourself to help kids who've been in situations like this?
Well, after abuse has occurred, there's different things that can happen. If it's determined that a child is still safe in the home and can remain there, then mental health professionals can provide certain types of treatment. One thing they can do is provide parent training in how to influence the child's behavior through positive reinforcement rather than physical discipline. Because part of the problem is that physical abuse can occur as a reaction to the child's behavior. So changing the way the parent responds to that behavior is very important. Another thing professionals can provide is something called parent-child interaction therapy. And this is where professionals work with parents and children together and basically coach the parents in specific skills. So in providing these services, what you really want to be promoting is safe, stable, and nurturing relationships between the parent and child.
How often, if ever, is there a socioeconomic connection? Are there people just as likely in high-income situations as low-income situations to abuse?
Abuse and maltreatment can cross all income groups, but that being said, poverty is a risk factor for child maltreatment, substance abusing parents, domestic violence in the home, low parental educational level, housing stress, those are all risk factors for abuse and neglect. So obviously services that address those, such as substance abuse services, domestic violence services, are very critical to helping break the cycle of abuse.
So are we more likely to see those situations? We just came out of a deep, deep recession. Were there signs that there were more and worse situations because of that?
Well, some people wondered about that and expected that, but the statistics are actually pretty confusing, so it's hard for me to answer that.
Okay. It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix, talking with child and adolescent psychiatrist Dr. Shane Tomasato of Desert Horizon Psychiatric Services and the Maricopa Integrated Health System. Shane, I don't know if you can address this, but in Arizona, probably in most other states, there's this feeling of trying to keep families together as much as possible, even after abusive situations. What are the pros and cons to that, from your perspective?
Well, of course, the cons are, is what if the child is really not safe in that environment? And it is very difficult to assess and make sure that there's absolutely no risk to the child's safety. So that would be the con of the child remaining in the home.
Mm-hmm.
The pros to it is that often children do have attachments to their parents, even though the parents may have been neglectful or abusive, and then that attachment is disrupted if they are moved to, say, a shelter or foster care. So when CPS deals with all of these issues, they have to try and balance all of those factors and really act in the best interests of the child.
Does a child ever feel safe telling another parent if the boyfriend, girlfriend, stepdad, stepmother is doing something?
Well, they sometimes do feel safe, and of course it helps if they have a good relationship with that parent or another caregiver, and they feel like that they will be supported if they reveal that information.
Okay. How important is the foster care system to this whole process?
Well, it's actually very, very important. The foster parents provide a great service to the kids of Arizona. It's much better than going to an institution, whereas, you know, decades ago, kids might be sent to orphanages or institutions when their parents couldn't care for them. It's much better to be in a family environment and to receive nurturing and get an idea and feeling for what good relationships are. And, of course, the foster care system in itself does have its own struggles as well, and in terms of maintaining quality and numbers of foster parents, it's always a challenge.
And Dr. Tomasato, I know you work with kids and adolescents, but I would ask another question about adults. How does one measure whether an abuser should get jail time, whether an abuser is someone who could be helped to change his or her ways?
Well, that would really, I think, need a case-by-case examination. For example, let's say that you had a single mother who was a very low income and had a really difficult time managing her children because she needed to also be at work and she didn't have caregivers and these children were neglected. Perhaps that is a case where just putting social supports in place, providing daycare, providing respite, providing mental health assistance, all of that can make a big difference. Whereas if you had another person who, let's say, was just in and out of the home and had was intermittently abusive to the child, and there did not seem to be all of these other extenuating factors, they just seemed, let's say, to be a dangerous person, then that is somebody who, of course, you would treat differently in the system.
Dr. Shane Tomasato is a child and adolescent psychiatrist for Desert Horizon Psychiatric Services and the Maricopa Integrated Health System. Shane, thanks for the time today.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. ASU and U of A will face off Saturday in this year's Territorial Cup game. The stakes are high for fans of the rival schools, and there are financial stakes for the two head coaches. KJZZ's Nick Blumberg reports.
According to a USA Today ranking, ASU's Todd Graham is the 37th highest paid college football coach in the country, but don't start crying for him just yet. Graham's pay was boosted to $2.3 million earlier this year, and while it won't happen this season, if he hits all the benchmarks in his contract, he could earn more than $3 million in bonuses. After clinching the Pac-12 South this past weekend, Graham's in line for at least a $230,000 bonus. A win Saturday will give ASU home field advantage in the conference championship a week later. If the Sun Devils beat Stanford in that game, Graham will rake in almost $500,000 extra. The University of Arizona's Rich Rodriguez is the 45th highest paid coach, taking in about $2.1 million a year. His contract makes him eligible for several hundred thousand in bonuses, including $100,000 for appearing in a BCS bowl game and $75,000 for a non-BCS bowl game. Nick Blumberg, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
ASU and the U of A are not alone in offering their head coaches extra incentives to succeed and join their athletic programs in the first place. And the money itself, even without bonuses, is shocking to some. University of Alabama head football coach Nick Saban, who's led his team to consecutive national championships leading to millions of dollars coming to the school, is earning more than $5.5 million this year. With me to talk more about college coaching salaries is Scott Herko, assistant professor of sport management at Central Michigan University and co-author of a study this year on coaching salaries. Hi, Scott. How are you?
Good afternoon. I'm just fine. How are you doing?
I'm good. Are you seeing trends that indicate schools are more willing to invest this big money into attracting coaches? And can we tell whether it's working out for them or not?
Well, absolutely. There is a trend in increasing coaches' salaries, and particularly football coaching salaries. And that trend is concerning with particular focus on the fact that there are some institutions that can afford that and some that really cannot, yet they're in the same competitive division. So, for instance, when you look at projecting out using inflation, projecting out to 2020, you see some conferences that are projected to pay football coaches upwards of 350% more than they did in 2005.
Wow.
And that is a significant concern and very difficult for those conferences that don't have access to those revenues to be able to keep up and maintain that competitive balance. So certainly what we're finding is across the board, not even at the most competitive levels of BCS automatic qualifying conferences such as a Southeastern Conference, but also at those conferences that are less competitive, such as the Mid-American Conference or even the Western Athletic Conferences, they are also willing to pay more money to hire football coaches in order to try to reach a certain level of success. And studies have shown that paying money for football coaches and paying more money for football coaches does not necessarily translate into success.
When you talk about those universities that can afford it, and obviously we have bigger TV deals with some of these conferences, but is that money coming from the university? Is it coming from big boosters? How big a difference does that make?
It makes a significant difference. Institutions that are a member of a BCS automatic qualifying conference have access to significant media revenues as well as donations that can be made by boosters that are tax deductible. And for instance, you may have ticket seat licenses at Arizona State or the University of Arizona, which donors can write off as tax deductible. And millions of dollars are earned by those institutions that are able to fill those seats and receive those types of donations. Whereas at the less competitive level, you know, ticket seat licenses are not an option. Mm-hmm. And so the revenues that are earned from, say, the Pac-12 network and from donations for ticket seat licenses are millions and millions of dollars that go into a system that in turn seems to go into the pockets of coaches. And that's where we're seeing a significant increase in the rise in coaching salaries. Go ahead.
I was going to say, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, I wanted to get into this idea of whether people should be concerned about the levels of these salaries. I was thinking about Todd Graham at Arizona State, who does have, in addition to the other incentives, does have the possibility for an academic bonus. Are university presidents looking enough at whether the academic and athletic missions are compatible?
That's an interesting question. I would say that academic bonuses are becoming more prevalent. And the reason why is because of the NCAA's new academic progress standards. And the NCAA will penalize athletic teams and institutions whose athletic teams do not meet minimum academic benchmarks, and they may not be eligible for postseason play and the compensation that may be received from that postseason. So, in other words, there is some level of competitiveness in the academic clauses and bonuses for coaches. You can look at it both ways. One is it's good for institutions to be focused on trying to improve the graduation rates of players. On the other hand, they're kind of being forced to do it, and part of it is financial reasons. They want to be able to please their donors, and they want to be able to please their fans, and they want to be able to receive a windfall from participating in the postseason. So academic bonuses are certainly becoming more prevalent in coaches' contracts, but the rationale behind them isn't all necessarily academically based.
Boy Scout, I guess I should be shocked that the motives aren't pure there, huh? Talking about the big money in college sports.
One of the things when you wanted to speak with me, I thought about in your introductory piece there talks about Nick Saban. He's making almost $6 million a year at the University of Alabama. Most of the highest paid public employees in states in our union happen to be either football or basketball coaches. And so if that's a system that we believe demonstrates our priorities or demonstrates the marketplace, I think that's something that we need to look at. As far as Nick Saban goes, I would argue that, okay, let's make him the highest paid coach in the land, which he is, but does he need to be paid $6 million a year? And my argument would be if he was the highest paid coach in the land and he was making $500,000 a year instead of $6 million, he would likely be just as intense, passionate, and probably just as effective as he is now. So the amount of money that's being generated by intercollegiate athletics is not being evenly distributed to other areas of higher education, which may be able to better use those resources.
Well, that's another thing that interests me, too. We talk about Alabama winning back-to-back national championships, and they win another one this year. They're ranked number one in the country again. The money that comes in from playing in one of these enormous bowl games or a BCS championship game, is that money distributed? We don't know exactly, I guess, at Alabama, but is that money distributed in such a way where it actually benefits the university as a whole? Or is it really more just about we can win more games? We can win more games next year and the year after that.
I think that's an area of debates. You can argue that the institutional prestige in the front porch of an institution can be elevated by participating in high-profile championship contests. Now, the measurement, the dollar measurement from that, the promotional return on that, is something that is difficult to equate and to quantify. However, I would also say that the amount of money spent to attain the top of the ladder is significant, and institutions continue to pay more money to try to reach that high level of success. And what's particularly concerning for me at a place such as Central Michigan University is that the Chippewas can't afford and they do not have the resources to be in the same competitive division as a Michigan or a Michigan State. And you see that play out across the country. So whether or not the revenues that are generated from the BCS help to elevate the bottom line of an institution, I would argue that BCS revenues largely are redistributed through conferences. And so the piece of the pie that Arizona State may receive for participating in the BCS championship game is going to be shared with other members of the Pac-12 conference. But that said, the prestige that is received is significant enough, and that the fan base and the alumni want to be able to chase and are willing to spend the money to attain that level. And that is concerning with respect to is that the best investment that can be made with those dollars? Are there other investments that can be made with the dollars that are generated? And that is a matter of debate.
Scott, I have about 30 seconds left, so I'm not sure we can answer this in that amount of time, but how much of a risk generally are universities taking when they decide to dole out these big salaries? Because obviously sometimes it works out very well, but oftentimes it doesn't.
It's a significant risk. Football is a zero-sum game. One team wins, another team loses. So for every Nick Saban that is paid a significant amount of money, there is a Charlie Weiss that is paid a significant amount of money and departs. You've got Jeff Tedford at University of California, Rick Neuheisel at University of California, Los Angeles, that were paid millions of dollars and were subsequently let go because of their poor coaching record. So, there may be a success, but for every success, there's a failure, and it is a significant gamble.
Scott, that's all the time we have. Scott Hurko, Assistant Professor of Sport Management at Central Michigan University, co-author of a study this year on coaching salaries. Scott, thanks for the time today.
Hey, thanks. I appreciate it.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll hear about three generations of the Norton family and their impact on water and agriculture in Arizona. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by St. Joseph's Hospital Heart and Lung Institute, offering a new FDA-approved treatment for the symptoms associated with acid reflux without pills. Appointments and information at 602-406-4000.
Good morning. This is KJZZ's Here and Now. We should see partly sunny skies and breezy conditions in Phoenix today. We're looking for a high of 71 degrees. That was our high yesterday. Clear skies tonight with a low of 52. Coming up at 12 o'clock, it's NPR's Here and Now from Boston. Today, the White House is cautiously optimistic as the deadline to fix the healthcare.gov website approaches. NPR's Here and Now starts at noon on KJZZ. Cloudy skies, 64 degrees at 11:43.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. The Colorado River continues to supply a significant amount of the water used in some parts of Arizona, but the percentage applied to agriculture in the state is drying up. The Norton family played a big role in the practical use of water in the Arizona desert. Through Patriarch John R. Norton's participation in the 1889 Breckenridge Survey that led to the site of Roosevelt Dam, his son John Norton Jr. helped craft Arizona's importance in supplying cotton and livestock to the rest of the country from the end of the Depression through World War II. Phoenix historian Jack August, the biographer of some of Arizona's most impactful elected officials, including Senator Carl Hayden and Governor Raul Castro, writes about the impact of the Nortons in his new book, The Norton Trilogy. August and 84-year-old John Norton III join me in studio. Jack, you've written about Carl Hayden, Raul Castro, Dennis DeConcini. Why isn't the Norton name as well known as those others?
The family, though politically active and engaged over three generations, and we started with the states. Let's just stay politically. States' rights. Then John's dad, who became one of the great agribusinessmen through sheer grit. He pulled the family in. John is a little child out of the Depression, and it was a rough time. And by 1940, he's a Pinto Democrat. He leads the states for Democrats for Wilkie. They were kind of getting FDR fatigue or New Deal fatigue, as it were, but then the war breaks out. The final generation, I think they know John becomes one of the great agribusiness titans, not only in Arizona, but throughout the American Southwest. While he's a principled conservative / libertarian today, I think one of the great things about him is his political engagement. Though he never ran for office, though he was asked to run for governor, everyone knew him, Bruce Babbitt, Dennis DeConcini. The Democrats could work with him, and he could work with them. It's such a different time. It's only maybe a generation ago, 20 or 30 years ago, where a conservative like Mr. Norton worked well and made policy with Democrats. There was some middle ground, and everyone was civil.
Mr. Norton, like it did to a lot of people, the Great Depression wiped out your dad, the wealth he'd accumulated. So what happened next?
In 1930, we were so poor that my father rented the grocery store in Cashin, Arizona, from Jim Cashin, who was a Texan. He ran the grocery store for a year or two till he get back on his feet. And I asked him later, I said, why did you take on that grocery store? You were a farmer. And he says, Well, he said, I figured I could snitch enough food out of it to feed you and your mother. So anyway, he ran the grocery store for a year or two. And then the Arena Company, which was an Italian family that had produce farming operations in several locations in California, wanted to branch in Arizona. They brought my dad in and they created the Arena Norton Company, which farmed produce. And this was in the early 30s. And they got going by the late 30s, by World War II. They were farming produce in all over the West Side and over in Chandler. And my dad, you know, that was the 1930s. The roads and the cars weren't quite as nice as now. And he had to go from Tolleson to Chandler and back a couple of times every day. I mean, he was a working fool. My dad really was a hard-working guy.
Jack, how much involvement did Mr. Norton's grandfather have in the early history of Arizona water? And by early history, I mean the late 19th century.
One of the first federal appropriations for the territory of Arizona in 1889 had to do with a matching grant from the county to do a survey of water storage. By the late 1880s, people are saying, what are we going to do? Can these private canal cooperatives and companies really do it? Can we get the capital from whether it's San Francisco, New York, or Europe? Can we do this, and can we run these in the private sector? The first toe in the water has to do with what's called the Breckinridge Survey of 1889, and it was that survey that John Norton, James McClintock, and William Breckinridge, who was the county surveyor, went up, and they traveled up there wasn't any Apache Trail then, but they were able to take their horses, and of course, who was the guy that took care of the livestock? John Norton, and he was one of the three of the Breckinridge Survey that located the Tonto Reservoir site, that is later, by 1911, Roosevelt Dam. So the beginning of our big water history and economic development begins with John's grandfather and continues on.
Family story is that they were riding, packed horses and mules up the Salt River Canyon, and they camped out. And they'd been on a trip for 7 or 8 days, I don't know. Anyway, all of a sudden, they came around a bend, and it opened up into this huge valley. They said, my God, we can put a dam right here. And that's where Roosevelt Dam went.
Even the primitive measuring devices they had, modern-day technologies, and then people that have studied said they were remarkably accurate about gradients and CFS, cubic feet per second flow, and all of that stuff. They were just remarkably accurate, and they measured by the stride of the horses.
Jack, coming back to more current days, when did the Norton relationship with agribusiness really change?
About 1989, John has arrived at a practical decision, though I don't know if he would say it this way, that it's time to get out of agriculture, and I've got to kind of reallocate the resources and my time into other economic ventures.
Besides, it's hard work.
Explain your lettuce.
Well, so that we could have all the seasons of the year. It's cooler here than it is in Imperial Valley. So you have lettuce in the Imperial Valley in midwinter, late December, January, February. And then you go to the desert areas, Phoenix, or we used to have a lot of lettuce down in the Marana area. And in April and October, and then we'd have lettuce in Cochise County in Wilcox, Arizona, which is 4,000 feet above sea level, and that's cooler yet. Right. We have lettuce in late September and May, and then we'd go up to Salinas. That was the summer deal. Salinas is a coastal valley and gets the coastal breezes all day in the summer, so you could have lettuce all summer, June, July, and August. So we were kind of a vagabond operation. We were moving our crews and our staff and our salespeople to each one of these districts when we were in a season. We did that for many years.
Jack, finally, you wrote about the three generations of Nortons. What's the legacy of this family as far as Arizona history is concerned? And are we losing some of that history as agriculture becomes less important or less a focus in the state?
We could somehow forget about the great contributions, the fundamental underpinnings of the economy here, the history of our economy here. It wasn't Intel or Motorola back in 48 coming in. That was a new economy that was, World War II certainly helped spur some of that and some other business titans. But through it all, agriculture was the raison d'etre for people coming to this area from all the way back from Jack Swilling, who was a Southern Confederate deserter and a drunkard, and he and the boys digging that ditch on in 1867 and 1868 were the building upon the Hohokam civilization. And from that time forward, it has been a story of water and putting water to beneficial use for agriculture, then ultimately the diversification of this kind of water use. And now, after, say, the 1980s and 1990s and into the 21st century, the role of agriculture is changing dramatically. And John, way back when he saw that groundwater depletion in the 40s and 50s, the role that water rights played in that titanic struggle with Arizona versus California, John was lived in that context. And the Nortons, in many ways, symbolize and personify a century and a half of water history and economic growth and development. And things are changing. I don't know. I can't foresee what's going to happen with agriculture in the future. That's one of the big issues that public policymakers and our elected officials need to decide.
Historian and author Jack August, also with John R. Norton III. August is the author of the new book called The Norton Trilogy. You're listening to Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein. There are a lot of Thanksgiving traditions, most of them associated with food. But while some members of the family are preparing that food and others are telling childhood stories, there are usually a few sitting in front of the TV watching an NFL football game. So since tomorrow will feature back-to-back-to-back gridiron contests, I thought it would be a good time to talk with Rich Cohen about his new book, Monsters, the 1985 Chicago Bears and the Wild Heart of Football. Many modern-day fans consider that Bears team to be the greatest in NFL history. It was full of dominant talents like running back Walter Payton and defensive linemen Richard Dent and Dan Hampton, plus wild personalities like quarterback Jim McMahon and head coach Mike Ditka. Cohen says he had a personal reason for writing about the team.
I was sort of a fanatic. I was a senior in high school in 85, but that team really started to come together. I mean, I've been a big fan since the mid-70s, and then they started to get really good. They had a great, great player who I loved who actually lives in Scottsdale named Doug Plank, who was the Bears' safety, free safety, number 46. He was called the human missile. He used to carry smelling salts in his own waistband to revive himself after big hits. And, I mean, he was just the kind of guy you love to watch. He'd play as hard as he can every single play. And he gave that defense when its name, the 46 defense, is named for Doug Plank's number.
This team was different, though, Rich, wasn't it? It was known off the field for its quirkiness, not just on the field for its success.
They were incredibly colorful characters. They had the Super Bowl shuffle, which then sort of gave them each their own tagline that sort of froze in your mind. They had four future Hall of Famers, five including Ditka, and it was sort of functional dysfunction. And the fact is that it wasn't just that they had all this stuff going on the sidelines, it was completely connected to the game. So their personalities played a huge part in how they played. You know, there was a great game, like the third or fourth game that year against Minnesota, where Jim McMahon wasn't supposed to play and he thought he should play, and him and Ditka were screaming at each other on the sidelines on national TV. You know, just shouting at each other. And finally, Ditka just sends him in, almost just to shut him up, and sends him in with a screen pass to Walter Payton. And you can see on TV McMahon changing it. You can see it at the line of scrimmage. And Ditka going crazy on the sidelines and McMahon throwing a 50-yard touchdown pass. And it was all that stuff. It was like, and you'd go to the games, and you actually got lucky enough to have a ticket. You could sit there on the sidelines and watch, you know, all the interactions and the way they dealt with each other. And it became almost like if you were watching The Godfather, but the guys in that movie were suiting up in pads and hitting each other. I mean, it was an incredible story. And think about football. The guys are armored. You can't see them. Most teams, you know, a few players. This was a team where every single player kind of became a breakout star. And I always said it was like the Beatles. You had a different kind of bear. It was like the Beatles. You had a different kind of bear for every kind of fan.
One issue finally getting more attention from the NFL is brain injuries, let alone the physical injuries that players have suffered. Did the reality of the players' current conditions make it more challenging to put this book together?
You know, almost 30 years have gone by, and I had this idea that it would be like my father's favorite book, which was Boys of Summer, about the 55 Dodgers.
Yeah.
And Roger Kahn went around in the mid-70s to members of that team, and he interviewed them, and then at the end of the interview, he asked them to play catch. And at the end of my interview with McMahon, I asked him to play catch. And he's like, and I brought a football along, and he's like, man, play catch, I can't even throw my keys.
Okay.
You know, and you realize this isn't baseball. This is an incredibly brutal, violent game. It's so interesting because it's the brainiest and the most brutal at the same time. It's tackle chess, as Doug Plank described it. And, you know, Doug Plank had a line. I don't think he was talking about physically, but it fits. He said, if you're lucky enough to be involved in something so intense when you're young, you pay for it with the rest of your life. And that's basically, you know, what's happened to these guys. And now it's really sort of critical for us as people that love the game to try to save the game from itself, I think. It happened again. It happened before. You know, in the early 1900s, football was almost outlawed because I think 17 college players died on the field one year. And they changed the game, and now they're going to be changing the game again, and it's a good thing because the very thing that makes these guys great football players puts them in danger, which is when you're 20 years old, 40 years old doesn't seem real. You just don't believe you're not thinking about it. You don't believe you're going to get there. And it's sort of the 40-year-olds, I'm 45, who have to sort of protect the 20-year-olds from themselves, you know, and that's like a serious responsibility, and it's a real change going on in the league right now.
Rich, finally, sports can bring families together as people root for the same team. Was it that way for you and the Bears and your family?
Unlike most people, I had to kind of root for the Chicago teams behind my father's back because he was of the belief that a Cubs fan and a Bears fan will have a bad life because they will accept losing as a natural condition of the world. So he tried to discourage me. So I had to sort of, it was like a secret vice of mine. And I do think that sports teams, I guess if I were to think about it, it's kind of like learning to be a citizen. It's kind of like nationalism on a scale that you can manage as a kid with the uniforms and the players and the team history. It all kind of evokes a national history and a world history. So I think it's kind of good training for living in the world and for also really loving something and really wanting something to happen and watching it not happen again and again and again and yet continuing to sort of pick up and go on. It's true for players and it's true for fans. And then for the starkest lesson of all, which is when what you've wanted to happen finally happens and it doesn't quite do it for you. You know, it does it for you for the moment, but there's sort of this letdown. I mean, Mike Ditka said after they won the Super Bowl, he said it was a letdown. It was like the Peggy Lee song, "Is That All There Is?" You know, so all of that is sort of training for life.
Rich Cohen, his new book is called Monsters, the 1985 Chicago Bears and the Wild Heart of Football. That's it for today's edition of KJZZ's Here and Now. If you'd like to hear this program or any past editions, you can go online later this afternoon to kjzz.org. Thanks very much to Nick Blumberg, Chicago Bears fan Nick Blumberg, for his help on today's program. Thank you very much for listening. We hope you have a great Thanksgiving and a fun, long holiday weekend. Now we head back to Boston for NPR's Here and Now on listener-supported KJZ.